So I'd like to, you know, welcome you guys to our webinar today. We're going to be featuring Jason Cohen. This is part of our ongoing webinar series here at ABB, where we're seeking out software-focused thought leaders to help share knowledge with our development community. Today, however, ABB was kind enough to allow us also to open the webinar to external guests. So I'd like to welcome, you know, both ABB developers as well as those joining us from around the web. So our guest today, as I just mentioned, is Jason Cohen, and he's interesting to talk to because he's started four companies. He's had two successful exits. He's currently running his fourth company, WP Engine, which offers WordPress hosting. But more relevant to ABB software engineers in particular is he's the founder of SmartBear Software, the company behind Code Collaborator, which is a popular code review tool. And this is something that many groups actually within ABB use today. He's also the author of a SmartBear blog that has over 40,000 subscribers, and that's actually how I ran across Jason and how I got invited to join us today. So just a bit more about why he's relevant and his stories are relevant to us here at ABB. So as software, you know, becomes a larger part, increasingly larger part of ABB's portfolio and strategy, it's important for us as the development community within ABB to have, you know, a deeper understanding of how we build and sell software or how to build and sell software. So, you know, we could look, for instance, at large corporations like Microsoft and Apple and try and learn from their stories, but I personally find this to be very difficult to do. I mean, the complexity of their stories really obfuscates any lessons that I think we would learn. You know, they're just dealing at a level of complexity that makes the lessons very hard to see. In contrast, what I like about Jason's story, especially his SmartBear story, is that it really offers clear insight into how to successfully build and sell software. He was what I would call laser focused on creating a company that did one thing well, code reviews. You know, he found that thing, he made thousands of customers happy, including customers that I worked with in my old company as well as this company, and made his company profitable. So the issues that he's talked about on his blog and that he's dealt with as he was building a software business, you know, from keeping customers happy with software that's, you know, a bit underperforming because you're trying to get it up to speed, to developing a sane pricing model with that software. These are some of the things that we're going to discuss today. So I'd like to welcome Jason here and everybody else to the webinar, but thanks for joining us, Jason. And Jason, I think you might actually still be muted. You want to... There we go.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Yeah, sorry we didn't...
Ooh, that's a good picture.
Yeah. That's Jason speaking at the... I think it's the Business of Software.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very nice pictures from that. That's where we found all our pictures to promote this webinar. Whoever was the picture taker there was kind enough to allow us to use the pictures, which is quite rare, it turns out, with pictures of you. So I guess we'll go ahead and get started. Before we get into, you know, really the directed questions that are really driving at some of the points that you've made on your blog, I think it's important that, you know, people hear a bit more about where you come from, get the story straight from you. You know, really, if you could just give a really short synopsis of your SmartBear experience, maybe like a couple minutes or something, especially the part where you, you know, you're just starting off and you had that period where you're starting, you know, just you, to the point where you're profitable and really making customers happy. So we're, you know, in this section, maybe just we're less interested on the exit strategy and things like that. We're really interested in the lessons about growing, you know, your user base and things like that.
Well, yeah, sure. So, I mean, there's not a lot of lessons in 2 minutes of an overview of the company, but so it's funny that you said we're laser focused on code review. I think an interesting part about the genesis of the company is that it did not start with a laser focus on code review at all. It started with an observation I had that version control systems, so today we would say things like Git, and but back then it was stuff like CVS and Perforce, and Subversion was just coming out. Version control, it seemed to me, was write many, read never. Right, like we just commit, and then it just disappears, and pretty much we use it to make sure that two developers don't stomp on each other's work, and that's about the extent of it. Sure, there's branching and so on as well, but like that was pretty much it. And it occurred to me there's a lot of information in there. You know, which files are we changing a lot? Like, for example, if you were working on a file that hadn't been changed in 9 months, how would you approach that change? Would you be more careful about testing? Would you just be more careful, period, with the change? Would you look a little deeper into the ramifications of that change versus a file that's been changed several times this week and you're making another change? So the first idea was a product that we did sell called Code Historian that would mine a version control system like the ones I just listed and show these kinds of views and ideally show them in the IDE, although actually I never really got that far. And that wasn't a very good idea, it turns out. It was interesting enough to get some people to use it and so on, but it turns out that's not particularly useful. And what would happen is people kept asking for these features, and I didn't know why. So they'd say things like, hey, can I email some of these diffs between two versions? Can I email them to somebody? And I would think, oh, why would they want to do that? But sure, I'll make an export feature that exports it to HTML, and then you can do whatever you want. You can print it out or email it or whatever. And then I get another feature request that say, like, hey, can I write on the code and then email it? I'm thinking, what is going on here, right? So eventually I sort of discovered by listening to the feature requests and listening to what people really wanted to do with the tool, it turned out that a lot of people wanted to use it for code review. And so I said, okay, and you know, still not recognizing this as a potential market, because there was no market for code review tools. There were no code review tools. So still not recognizing that's maybe a possibility, I just started hacking up stuff and created a product called Code Reviewer, which was basically the first product, Code Historian, literally just hacked up enough to bundle something up, have some comments on it, and shuttle it around to people. And it was a terrible architecture. Like, everything about it was sort of bad. It was the worst possible way to do it. But it was enough, since the alternative for a lot of people was nothing at all or printing things out, it was enough to discover that that was actually a thing. It took 2.5 years from the formation of a company and first putting Code Historian on the website to the first employee. And the reason that's important is because with the advent of the first employee, I was able to then take a step back and rewrite this mess of a code reviewer into a code collaborator, which was designed this time correctly, because now I had 2.5 years of rear view mirror I could use, plus all the feature requests that made a lot of sense, but we couldn't hack into Code Reviewer anymore, and then I could make that. And that was really when the company started taking off, because that was the right product in the right market. The final thing that really made the company take off was when I wrote this book about code review, that little red book, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. There's a lot of reasons why writing that book made the company successful. And it's not just sort of the obvious marketing stuff. There's more sort of to it than that, which we can get into, of course. But the point is that it was a seminal thing to do, and it became a fundamental way that the company was able to grow and market itself and so on and position itself from then on. And so not getting into the exit part, that's sort of the evolution of it. And it wasn't until, I think, 5 years in, maybe 6 years in, that we kind of took a look at the products we had. We had 6 at that time, and said, wow, Code Collaborator is 98% of the revenue, but it is less than 98% of the support ticket, so guess what? But we should focus. So thanks for saying we're laser-focused. It took me kind of, I don't know, half a decade to get laser-focused on Code Collaborator, but then we were.
Interesting. So one of the things that struck me as you were talking is, I mean, I don't know all the history of Code Collaborator and Smart Bear, but from what I remember, I'm pretty sure you did this fairly quickly after coming out of undergrad. But you seem to have had a pretty good understanding of the software space. Just curious about your background there. Did you have any research background or interning background, or what was your background really as you were starting Smart Bear?
Yeah, I did not start that coming right out of school, but it wasn't my first job. But yeah, in the late high school, I was an intern at a Tracor Aerospace here in Austin in software, and then throughout college, I always had a job writing software. In fact, almost the entire time. I was at a company for 4 years during college, so almost the whole time at a certain company called Photodex, also here in Austin. Then there was other stuff between that and SmartBear. So there was a few things, yeah. But no formal MBA training, no PhD work, no finance degree, although that would have been helpful to at least take in one class in finance before embarking on my own. But I mean, the thing about a startup is that you're going to have to figure everything out. There's all of the things to figure out and do. Almost no founder goes into a startup knowing how to hire and scale human beings in every single department and all the rules and regulations around finance that will end up, being important, or even around HR for that matter. Or you don't know what kinds of problems you'll run into in a technical sense, or how to run a tech support company, or how to build a sales force, an outbound sales force, or an upgrade that is an inward-facing sales force. And then you just go down the list. None of these things are known. Marketing, too. Marketing today, of course, is wildly different than it was when I started SmartBear. So there's no such thing as knowing how to market in, for example, social media, which didn't exist. So by definition, most things are going to be new. So just having a PhD or, having some skill in one thing or another, not actually terribly helpful, because almost all the things you'll have to figure out are going to be new to you regardless of where you come in from.
Yeah. So getting back to some of the questions I wanted to make sure we hit on, one of the things that, and the reasons we had you here is you've had a, remarkable string of successes. Obviously, you're still quite young, but you've already done SmartBear and exited there. Now you're working on WP Engine, which seemed to be going quite well, as well as just recently receiving significant funding. Just a bit on the lessons of your work with some of these successes. Do you have any thoughts on maybe the top one or two attributes that have led to these success in terms of, these can be internal things, your personality or working really hard, or external things, hitting the market at the right time? Do you have any thoughts on, again, just the one or two attributes that you think are maybe the most important to the success of these companies?
No, definitely not. And I think that's actually the important point. It isn't like you have one or two attributes and so you're successful. That's not the case. But yes, of course, work really hard. Of course, I work my ass off. But who doesn't when they're a founder? I guess if you don't and you fail, well, there you go. But generally, you do. And generally, you don't say the company failed because the founder didn't have enough horsepower or didn't work hard enough or et cetera. So do you have to be in the right place at the right time? Well, in retrospect, of course, sort of by definition, if you're in the wrong place or at the wrong time, I guess by definition, then you won't be successful. But who knows that? Who can really know that until it's a decade later and you look back and ask, oh, now we can do Uber, but we couldn't do Webvan. You can't know that. And so it almost doesn't matter. So no, it's not about... Plus, you read about one founder and they're egotistical and arrogant and everybody hates them, but they're such a force and people respect them and there's that kind. But then there's exactly the other kind, the people that build... cohesive groups, and they're the friendliest guy in the room, and his statement is he never has the answers, that's why he has a team, and just the opposite. Like, you can take any characteristic, and except maybe, I don't know, laziness or something, but you could probably take any characteristic and take the opposite and show a successful founder has that opposite characteristic. So no, I don't think it's one or two things.
Right. Yep. Good point. All right, so one of the things that I really like I saw in one of your posts is this idea, and this is especially important, I think, for technical people delivering to customers, is I think your post was called Put Down the Compiler Until You Learn Why They're Not Buying. And that, this touches a bit on the points you brought up earlier. But I think it's really important as technical people, who are mainly the types that are listening to us today, to think about, the non-technical aspects of their product, especially customer interest and things like that. Can you maybe elaborate on your strategies for avoiding this problem of building the wrong thing or becoming too focused on the technical details?
Well, here's the easy way to think about it. The thing you, as a technical person, the thing you know you can do is build the product, whatever it is. And there's another feature, you know you can build it. You know it. You just have to go heads down and type, and you will do it, and you'll do it at a good enough quality that you can ship it. That's almost certain. So, of course, the difficult things in a startup are the things that are not certain. And in fact, if you think about this strictly from an engineering perspective, suppose you had a project that's going to take a year, and of course some aspects you know are just work, and some aspects are going to take exploration and take things to figure out, and they're not known right now. And you ask, in what order should I do these things so this project is likely to be successful? And of course, what you don't do is put off the unknowns and just work on the stuff you know you can do. What you do is you tackle the things you don't know and you investigate, you try to scope them, you try to understand them better. Maybe you have to scope them down, maybe it's not what you expected and it's much worse, so that means you have to change the product in the first place and the roadmap. Of course, you tackle the things you don't know first. That is the correct way to do any engineering project. So the company is the same. But in a company, all of the bits of the code are actually all the parts that are fairly well known. The things that are not known are, where are the customers, who are they, how will you get in front of them, how will you get their attention, how will you keep them coming through the web page or however it is that you reach them, how will they sign up, will they sign up, how much will they pay, how do you know that, will they stay after that, if it's a recurring revenue company, will they stick around? You know, of course, with recurring revenue, the customer experience is continuous, otherwise they leave. And you just keep going. These are the unknowns. So these are the things to tackle first, not the product. So for example, with WP Engine, my current company, which as you point out is you know quite successful. We have 145 employees now, growing really fast, all top line revenue, no trials, no free trials, no freemium, no any of that kind of stuff. And when I started the company, I had no name of the company, no employees, no website, no PowerPoint. I had nothing. It was just these kind of conversations like we're having right now. This was it, trying to say, if I built a way to host WordPress where it costs $50 a month, that's 50, which is probably 10x what you're used to paying a Dreamhost, I'm telling you the site will be fast. It will scale if you get a bunch of traffic. We'll handle security for you. And if you pick up the phone and call, we'll know WordPress. We won't just say the server's running, so it's your problem. And by the way, we'll have a staging area so that you can test stuff out for us before it goes live. Would you pay $50 a month for that? Now, of course, it took me 40 or 50 conversations to get it that crisp. At first, I was fishing around. I didn't know what was the price. But then it got that crisp, and it was easy to get a yes eventually. I had other ideas. I went through the same process. It wasn't easy to get to yes. But the point is that this was all done with nothing but just talking to people. Nothing at all but that. And so the point being only that it is tackling those unknowns, even if you have literally nothing but a conversation. That is how you de-risk the project, if I'm using engineering sort of terminology, which you can. And so, you know, some people say, well, engineers have to get un-engineer-y to work on these other things. You have to not think like an engineer to do marketing or not think like an engineer to do sales and so on. And I disagree. I absolutely think that it makes sense for an engineer founder to think like an engineer in all the aspects. That's totally fine. So do so and realize that these other things that you're less experienced in and where the variables really are less known is what you need to tackle first for that very reason, for an engineering reason.
So one of the things I wanted to follow up on is you had mentioned, you know, basically trying to get the attention of developers and trying to get your product in front of them, especially, you know, let's take the case of SmartBear. I realize that the example is going to be a little bit dated, but you know, having marketed a bit, just a little bit, to developers in the past, I find it an interesting group to market to. Do you have any? How did you go about marketing to developers when you're marketing Code Collaborator, for instance?
I think the question is how do you you know, what's your approach versus what are the tactics? Because, for example, one of the things I used was AdWords. But at the time, I was literally the only ad for the keyword CVS. Like, CVS Pharmacy hadn't even gotten online yet, right? So for 5 cents a click and the only ad there, I could have the keyword CVS. So clearly it doesn't matter what my experience was. It doesn't matter what I learned because nothing like that exists. And again, there was no social media. Today, social media is, of course, perhaps more important than many of these other channels. Also, I did really well with magazine ads. These magazines generally don't exist at all in physical form, like Dr. Dobbs and so forth. Those don't exist in physical form anymore. So who cares? There's a lot of interesting things about that, I think, but who cares? So I think maybe the more interesting question is, you know, what is the attitude towards selling to engineers and so on? So the first thing I'd say is engineers have this, well, I think a lot of people have this, by the way, but we'll just say engineers have a sequence in their DNA where if they detect any kind of sales bullshit whatsoever, it's gone. So any salesperson who is not technical, who can't answer the questions, who doesn't understand, especially if they try to fake it, and if they start giving you that, hey man, how's it going, kind of like a thing, instant turn off, this isn't happening. On the other hand, if what you do is simply sit down and geek out about the thing, just geek out. That works really well. So for example, at SmartBear, we had millions and millions of dollars a year in revenue with zero salespeople, and that's enterprise sales, right? Our customers were people like Cisco, Qualcomm, Microsoft, EA, Cognos, IBM. I could just keep going, but like these are all companies where you'd expect, you'll need a sales force, it's enterprise sales, it's that kind of agreement, which they were. But what I would do is simply demo the product and geek out, and that's what works. And so you can take that sort of concept and apply it to lots of different media. So what does that mean in social media? It means you don't use the usual like, oh, hey, check out a white paper with six things. It's really a transparent bullshit thing that would never, ever be on Hacker News. Wrong. What you do is do things that would be on Hacker News because that's how interesting it is. Because that's where the engineers are. They're reading stuff on Hacker News. So what is so interesting it would be on Hacker News? That's good content. That's the good things to talk about. Or how can you make your company Twitter account be, in fact, a good source of information about the topic that you have? So if it's code review, like obviously other people, not just your own company, have lots of things to say about code review. What is it like at GitHub, for example? What about competitors even? What are other things people are doing? Even people that think code review is stupid. Like if you take the totality of things that are that and make sure that your Twitter feed or your blog, et cetera, is a source for that, then sort of, and it's honestly a great source for that, then sort of naturally anyone who is interested in that topic will want to follow that. And that is a good use of social media because, again, you're geeking out on the subject. I think thinking about, here's another like interesting analogy. If you go to, like recently I went to Academy to get a soccer ball, and the person who's standing at the wall of soccer balls instantly just started geeking out about soccer balls, which is like, it's a soccer ball, what the hell, right? Oh, but there's this kind and that kind, this pattern, but and instantly he's like, look, I know you're not big on soccer, so like this one's really cool because if you can do this, you can do that, and it's the FIFA standard and whatever, but listen, I know you can't do it, so who cares, just buy this one, it's actually cheaper and you won't know the difference, and look, if you get better, come back and you can buy that. In other words, you just geeked out, not a salesman. And yet that's exactly what I needed because they gave me the comfort, because I was receiving truth, they gave me the comfort to buy. And again, I think that's a good like technique and a good mindset when selling to engineers. Actually, I think it's a good mindset selling to anybody, period. But I think in particular engineers have the bit inside them that flips out if you, we used to call it the bozo bit. You kind of get the benefit of the doubt, but as soon as they figure out, oh, you're a bozo, the bit flips and that's it. And so the thing is just to be consistent with being that kind of open, geeky engineer. In other words, just be an engineer like your customers are, because that's what we like, is to geek out on stuff.
It's interesting. Like, I'm curious as to how, like, as I've tried to market software tools in the past just a little bit, it's very difficult to walk that line. I mean, you can talk about the technical stuff. I guess that's basically what you mean by geek out, but it's very easy to lead into the benefits of this technical approach. I mean, how do you walk that line between, you want to present the interesting technical things. Obviously, those have benefits. How does that not sound like marketing?
Well, now you're getting to, like, do you do benefit sales or solution sales and so on? I think with developer tools, if it's not really obvious what the benefit is, then I don't think you're going to argue your way into it.
Okay.
So, for example, with code review, if you just fundamentally think code review is not an effective way to do code, to develop stuff, I'm probably not going to convince you by arguing with you for 30 minutes. Now, what I can do maybe is give you some interesting data, and you might look at that data and say, I don't know if I believe this or not. But is there a path for me to test this for myself? Maybe that's enough of a benefit of the doubt that I'll test it for a week. So this is what I used to say. I say, look, get the tool. At SmartBear, we did have trials. So get the trial. Do code review for a week. And don't measure a thing. Don't measure anything. Just do code reviews. And then at the end of the week, gather everyone up and just say, hey, do we feel as a team that we uncovered bugs faster than we would have? Do we feel like we've actually learned from each other? And do we feel like that was a good use of our time? Now, not every single minute has to be a good use of our time, because clearly, maybe we did waste some time in some areas, and we didn't waste time in other areas, and of course, it's only 1 week. We'll get better at this process over time, but do we feel like there's enough there to continue? Don't do an ROI spreadsheet. Don't do a lot of metrics. Just do that and say, how did it go? And I used to say, look, if it's not obvious to you at the end of the week that it's valuable, then don't do it, because code review takes a lot of time, and that's the most valuable thing. So if it's not obvious, don't. But if it seems like maybe it is, then maybe this tool is helpful. Maybe you do then want to start measuring a few things to understand it better. Maybe you are interested in reading this book about code review to do some best practices and so on. In other words, maybe now you say, yes, now let's optimize, and that's fine. So I think, again, that's a very straightforward thing. It's great for engineers' argument because it's very experimental. Just do it. And you're not trying to throw a lot of data and numbers and ROIs and crap that who believes that anyway? Have you ever bought anything really based on an ROI of some kind? I don't think so. In fact, I think it's even a good sales technique with engineers to make fun of sales techniques. I used to joke, the thing about ROI is, so supposedly we saved $1 million by doing whatever. So where's the $1 million? I didn't get a bonus check. I'm not working less. Where's the $1 million? I didn't see it. What do I care? Where'd that go? Of course, it doesn't go like that, right? Hopefully it goes in the form of something like we worked on better problems or something like that. But we didn't get to go home early, so I don't know where that is. So I used to just make fun of that and just say, now the serious thing is, is this in fact a more efficient way to find these kinds of bugs, and therefore is that just better? And we'll just go from there, right? Not that there's nothing to measure, but like, can we agree on the high level point there? So the code review is a process argument, so that's interesting. But you have other kinds of tools. So say it's a plug into Eclipse and it does this and that and the other thing. Again, either a developer uses that plugin and is like, oh, sweet, I don't want to uninstall this, or they don't. Like, that's just the case. And like, you listing benefits, I think listing use cases to show them this is what you could do, because they may not think of all the things they could do with it. And if you say, look, you may not have thought of this, but look at this. With this, you can now do boom, 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 and see that? Oh, sweet. Now, in a way, that's a benefit statement. Or maybe it's a feature statement of some kind. Really, it's just showing this is what it's like. But again, I feel like for engineers, if it's not them, obvious to them, that like, oh, well, I want to do that. That sounds good. Or, you know, I trialed it and I was successful with it. If that's not the case, I don't think you're going to argue your way in with bullet points about benefits.
Yeah, it's interesting. We see in the, you know, a lot of us in ABB work in the .NET community, and one of the most successful, you know, extensions for Visual Studio is this ReSharper extension. And their approach is basically, I think their slogan is develop with pleasure. And I've yet to see really benefit statements or anything like this. It's all about the developers at these code camps and conferences. They're rabid for ReSharper. They love it. There's no clear reason why they love it. They just will never uninstall that tool. So I think as a company that's really taken that kind of experiential approach and been really successful. So one of the things I want to talk about with your experience at WP Engine is I know you guys recently received a very healthy round of funding. You know, congratulations on that. I know you're scaling quite a bit. Obviously we're in a big company. ABB has around 150,000 employees, huge company. So we don't have exactly the same problems where we're scaling a small startup. But there is an interesting analogy. We do have, you know, for instance, projects that are kind of pilot projects. So they'll start off in a big company. It's just a few of us working on them. And then all of a sudden, that will be deemed successful and it will need to be scaled. The group will grow hugely and, all of a sudden you're basically scaling. It's as if you got funding, and you did get funding. It's just internal funding. So it'd be interesting to hear about your experience, you know, scaling it from, you know, one or two to 100 or 50, you know, depending on when you think the most interesting inflection points are.
What about it?
Well,
There's a ton of things. They're scaling the technology, they're scaling people, they're scaling engineering teams versus sales versus support. I mean, this is a career. clearly there's an inflection point where you start to have meetings, because not everyone knows everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes a thing, and now suddenly you need some kind of management, and there's some, of course, organizations which actually don't quite work with formal management, even at the scale of hundreds of people. But of course, that doesn't mean there's not people who are connectors and nexus points of things. Often those folks, you know, kind of subdivide into small groups, and therefore, you know, to retain that. So there's all kinds of ways you can do it. I think, you know, it really depends on so much on the nature of the product. So for us, you know, the customer service is such a big deal for us as part of the product. So literally half our employees are in support, and so that means scaling support is, you know, a much bigger, more complicated task than it might be for another company where you have 3 people or 8 people in support and it's not 24/7. That's a very different way to scale. So, I mean, I'm not sure there's like one overarching thing there. There's all the usual sorts of things. You know, at 150, it's hard to know everyone's name anymore and so forth. But, I mean, and what do you do to promulgate culture as you scale? What does that mean for hiring and firing, as you know, as the case may be? I mean, there's just a million topics on that. But and then, you know, technology is its own scaling problem. Again, depending on what kinds of depending on the product, that may or may not be hard. It is hard for us because it's hosting, and so we have thousands of servers. So there's lots of things that happen there. Whereas, you know, install base customers have other kinds of problems, like a proliferation of different versions, and you have different kinds of problems with installed software. So, I mean, it really, I hate to say it depends, but it really does.
Okay. I was just, kind of looking for maybe the one or two things that had kind of bugged you most about.
There's nothing in startups where there's the one thing. Everyone wants the silver bullet. That's not how it works. I forget who coined this first, but there's a saying, there's no silver bullet. There's just a lot of lead bullets. That's the case.
Interesting. Cool. Well, one of the things that was really interesting about the growth of Smart Bear and, you know, Code Collaborator is how it seems like, you know, from the outside, it seems like it was driven partially, at least, by the book you wrote. And this book is The Best Kept Secrets of Peer Code Review. And one of the things you did there is you did the largest ever case study of peer code reviews, which I think, you know, is probably a true statement of having come from academia myself in the past. You know, it's just really difficult to ever, as an academic type or just as any type, to get enough developers to do kind of a real case study on any new technology. So I'm really fascinated. I think in your book you did a 10-month period at Cisco where you had 50 developers and performed 2,500 reviews on 3.2 million lines of code. So I'm really interested in what you think are the top findings from this study. What do you think the main outcomes of the study are?
Yeah, well, that I can definitely elucidate that. But I'd say, just to your point of, like, it's hard to do those. It is hard to do those because everyone's got work to do, and the last thing they need to do is experiment while they're working, right? So I think if you're looking for the one piece of advice, as you like to get, look for people who are already doing it, whatever it is. They're already doing it, but it should be better your way. And so, will they link arms and say, well, since we're doing it anyway, and since this has a good chance of being better, that makes it worthwhile to try the thing. Because, so in their case, they were doing code reviews anyway, and they were going to do them, but they were doing them in these really painful ways. And so even a product like ours, even if they were to put up with bugs and so forth, would still probably be less effort and more enjoyable than whatever the alternative was. And so therefore it was useful to do. And so for us to say, hey, let's do this together, and together we'll also find out some best practices, because of course that will also help you. And so that kind of, like, go where they're already doing it, I think, is actually a good sort of generic piece of advice about that. Anyway, the results were pretty clear. So there's kind of 3 main results from that which are interesting for anyone writing code, period, and then in particular if you're doing code reviews. So the first one is something you might expect would happen, but it's interesting to know exactly what the numbers are. So you can chart on the x-axis is time passing, and the y-axis is how many defects did I find in the code on average. So as you would expect, as you spend time looking at the code, you find defects, no kidding. What's interesting is it's really linear. This is on average, obviously. It's really linear where you find about one interesting problem every 10 minutes. And it's linear until about 40 or 50 minutes in, 4050. And then it curls off, and you can spend another 30 minutes and maybe you'll find one thing. And there's, of course, several ways you can interpret that. One is you sort of are exhausted in a certain way, right? You're sort of mentally not being sharp. Another way to look at it is you sort of found the low-hanging fruit. So the additional things to find, if they're even there, are harder to find. Or maybe there aren't as many to find in the first place. You're fishing in ponds. Like, there's many ways you can interpret it, but this is a very consistent result. And it's also interesting to know exactly what that time frame is and so on. And if you think about it, actually, this by itself is a great argument for code review. Because what other thing do we do in software engineering where every 10 minutes we find a bug? And not only do we find it, we know where it is in the code. So it's not like QA where it's a thing and then we have to go dig around of what's the actual cause and so on. What is it that we have that every 10 minutes we find exact point in the code a bug? That's pretty efficient. Well, only for about 40, 50 minutes, but still, that's why that's an interesting best practice. So spending some time like that precisely. So that was useful. Second thing that was interesting is the quantity of lines of code put in front of your face to do a review of. If you dump a phone book in front of someone and say, review it, obviously, like, that's intimidating, and you end up just going, and sort of flipping through it. So the result is that you don't find many defects that are, in fact, there. Again, it's sort of maybe obvious to say that, but so the interesting thing is in the actual numbers. So anything over about 200 lines of code, and by this I usually mean diffs, like it's not a source file that's 200 lines, but rather 200 lines of diffs that you're reviewing. Anything over that, you find many fewer defects than you would have found. And so what that then suggests, in terms of the rest of our process in software development, is small changes are better than big changes, which of course, again, is kind of generally something that we all probably know is true, that big, huge changes is scary and bad. Maybe they're not when you have tons of unit tests, but still, in general, they feel scary and bad. And they are scary and bad, and not just because code review is hard, although that too, because if code review ceases to be a tool, useful tool to find defects, that is bad, right? That is bad for code quality. But also maybe you can use that as a sort of demonstrating there's other things that probably are also risky and bad too. It's not just that. It's because human beings aren't really capable of looking at 3,000 lines of code difference and making sense of it in any form, whether it's code review or otherwise. So maybe that's a good indication for us as developers. And, you know, not only does that suggest then, oh, well, we should modularize and use smaller functions, make unit tests, like, of course it suggests all that. Of course we sort of all know that. But it's interesting to have evidence and data on like, the number of lines of code even, where that happens to cleave. Then if you put those two things together, you can get some notion of, like, well, if I shouldn't review for more than an hour and I shouldn't review more than 200 lines of code, you know, you sort of can put that together to see, I can really think about 200 lines of code an hour. And so that's not a different finding, it's just dividing, but it's still an interesting thing to take away into any time you're writing code or doing things or looking over someone's shoulder. Sort of a final thing that's useful is there's code reviews where the author walks the reviewer through the code, and there's code reviews where the reviewer is given the code in isolation and they look at it. And it's really interesting to ask, like, is one better or you know, et cetera. I think most code reviews are the over-the-shoulder style where the author points out stuff and so on. I find that those are not very useful. And the reason is that the author is driving and sort of says, I did this because of X. And the reviewer goes, that makes sense. And he says, I did this because of Y. And the reviewer says, yeah, that makes sense. And in a weird way, the author is almost selling the reviewer on it rather than the reviewer being critical and double-checking. Because the way you really do it as a reviewer is you'd think, is that the right function? And then you'd go dig around in the code and yourself and go see if there's any side effects there and so on and so forth. That's what you would actually do if you were investigating and being critical, right? Or if there's something trivial, you may write it down if you're doing this separately, but you may not bother to interrupt the author, even just socially, as the author's driving you through it. So I really feel like that the sort of author-driven reviews are less useful. The exception is I do like it when the author runs through his own review first before giving it to the reviewer separately. Because what ends up happening is by having to kind of say it out loud or explain, it causes you to rethink. And that actually causes you to find a lot of your own issues. Like you explain, I did this because of X, Y, and Z, and then you realize, wait a minute, that actually doesn't make sense. Right? When I say that out loud, it doesn't make sense anymore, and you go back. And that's actually extremely efficient. And that gets, and this will be the last point on this, but this gets like a really interesting final point, which is self-code review. If you look at the code in something other than the IDE, so that it's sort of in a refreshed form, and you pretend that you're explaining to someone else, is super effective. And it doesn't involve anyone else, and it's free. No tools, no process, no metrics, and not even other people. And it's actually fairly effective at finding problems. And so I really recommend that, regardless as a tool, especially if you're doing code that that isn't trivial, that you do kind of sense in your heart of hearts, like, yeah, this is, I'm not that comfortable with this. I'd recommend that as a thing that anyone can do, of course. Maybe do it by looking at diffs in a different editor or use GitHub or whatever. It's a good trick.
Yeah, that sounds great. I must agree with the over the code, over the shoulder code reviews being not quite as effective. I mean, one of the benefits of doing the on your own code review, looking at somebody else's code on your own, that I really find important as somebody that is maintaining and reading other people's code all the time, is you do a kind of an early simulation of, hey, what is this going to look like to me in a year when I have to look at it, you know, later on? Is it readable? You get all these readability issues out of the way kind of early on in the life cycle of the software. So, yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And I think this 200 lines or about 40, 50 minutes, I think that's an important finding for ABB developers to be aware of. As I mentioned, we're doing code reviews too, so that's a great point to bring up. So what I wanted to do now is just take a few minutes. If anybody in the crowd has a question, feel free to chat it. The chat dialogue is kind of to your right if you're not familiar with WebEx. One of the ones that we do have on chat already, we'll just do a few of these. I know Jason is a busy guy, so we can't keep him but so long. But one we have already is the question, how do you use customer feedback to steer your business? When did you know the feedback gives the correct direction to take?
So I think you have to go into customer feedback realizing the customers can't design features or your software. What they can do is relate their experience, their pain, their frustration, their life, the things they're trying to accomplish, that they can do with high fidelity. What they can't do very well is suggest features. Some people know that and don't suggest features, but engineers are notoriously bad at saying, you know what you should add is X, you know what you should do is Y, it would be perfect is add a button over here. And every engineer fancies themselves really good at this. And they also fancy that they understand how your code works and what's therefore easy or hard. And so engineers are sort of notorious to say, look, it'd be really easy if you just, and they say something that may or may not be easy and may or may not even make sense, that, and they're not thinking through all the use cases. They don't know what all your customers are going through. So you have to be very careful when you get that to realize there's probably something good going on there, but not listen really to the feature request, but ask, why are they asking for that feature? What are they actually trying to accomplish? And then is that thing that they're trying to accomplish something you want them to accomplish? If so, that's how you would, kind of receive that feedback. That's sort of the good and bad part about engineers, because the good part of that, so that's the bad part, is that they think they know how to add the feature, and you kind of can't do that all the time. The good part, though, is when a feature is too difficult to do or it's just too complex, an engineer, you can often describe why. You can say, see, what happens is, and you can describe these complex scenarios or these other things that other customers deal with. And often the engineer is like, oh, yeah, I didn't realize there was all that stuff. Okay, that makes sense. Well, keep it on your list. And actually can put it to bed, where that's not true with a non-technical person. You can't even have that discussion, right? So that's the sort of good and bad. How do you know if they're right? Again, if you're listening to what they're trying to do and the pain that they have in their life, they're always right because they're relating what their experience is. And, of course, then you have to talk to many of them so that you don't just do something that's idiosyncratic to one person. And you just take the things that are big patterns or the things that you personally feel are a very valid point that you do want your product to do. And that's how you can, use that to guide. I think something like user voice where people vote for things is useful as an input. It shouldn't, of course, be your project plan or your product plan. But it is, of course, a great way to collect. If you're fortunate enough to have lots of customers, it's a good way for them to have feedback and major patterns bubble up to the top, so that's awesome. So I do think there's use in that sort of tool as well. That's all if you sort of have an existing product. If you don't yet have an existing product, then the question is, how do you use early customer feedback to form what the company or product even is, and how do you know if that's right? In that case, I would say this. As you talk to more and more people, are the things that they're saying and the problems they're having, is that converging on a couple of tenets? Or is it that every time you talk to someone, you're sort of hearing a different story? Again, they're different pain points, different perspectives, different desires, different budgets, different ways that they would buy, different ways they perceive the product, different words they use to describe what's going on. Some people have this pain, some don't. So I think, and again, I've been through this as well, that I had an idea for a company before WP Engine. I went through the very same process and decided it was a bad idea, exactly because as I talked to people, it was divergent. All these different categories I just mentioned, everyone had this pretty different story. It didn't seem to converge on a thing that was the central truth. So I think this feeling of divergence or convergence around what you're seeing as you talk to 10, 20, 30, 40 people is part of the guide there.
Yeah, I think an interesting point you bring up there is the talking to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people. For instance, before you started WP Engine, I mean, how many people did you end up talking to before you kind of felt comfortable with moving forward with this idea?
About 50, 50.
50, okay, that's a lot of people. That's great, though. All right, so I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. We've really appreciated you coming and joining us here today, Jason. We really appreciate it. Appreciate you putting up with my first interviewing experience. We're going to be placing this on the ABB internet for those of you within ABB so that you can share this with your friends. And for those external, thanks for joining us. I think we might be also posting this externally. I'll get a note out to you on whether we do that. And thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
All right. Take it easy.